Greetings, comrades, and welcome to the February 2020 installment of Poet Radio on WGXC. My name is Chris Funkhauser, and in this interval, we will be paying homage to the wonderful Caribbean writer Kamau Brathwaite, who passed away earlier this month at age of 89. Somewhat uncharacteristically, I'm going to begin the show by reading one of Kamau's poems, which appeared in the literary journal Hambone in 1991. Glass for Gordon Roller. Through corneas of glass I see my people, black. I see them homeless still and shiftless, slack and hungry, white-lipped, ray-mouthed, beggar at the corners, bugged, drugged, crying out loud to the enemy for bread. They cannot worship their dead, their ancestors of centuries, steps when they must beg, handcuffed, backs to the cold wind for shelter, stick, wall, roof, stockade of warmth when they must eat those books you offer them, pink proverbs, blue-eyed revelations. I see my sisters, Arethas, Angelas, how they have burnt their hair so near to God, how they embalm their bread of breasts, how they forget the Sphinx, accept your Gentile Venus. I see my brothers high and nodding, shadowboxing to the tune of needles, angels of the fix, bartering their sanity for trips around the skeleton. I hear them screaming, revolution, as the world revolves round Marcus, Malcolm, Mississippi, Memphis. But there ain't no vein of revolution, only the blues and Coltrane's gospel pain. I became aware of Brathwaite's work as a reader of Hambone, a publication edited by Nathaniel Mackey in Santa Cruz, where I was living in the late 80s and early 90s. Mackey's interview with Brathwaite in Hambone 9 really broadened, if not exploded, my understanding of poetry and poetics. In it, he addresses poetry and continuum in the Caribbean, nuances in his trilogies The Arrivance and the Mother Poem, Son Poem, and Ex-Self trilogy, magical realism, and a host of other topics. He addressed writers I was familiar with, saying this: I've never found Pound able to reconstitute elements. It seems as if he was breaking them down, and therefore I found the poetry dry, arid, hard to get to. Eliot I was always attracted to by his speaking voice, as I've said over and over again, but I find him, again, well, I suppose it was a post-war expression of his, too much concern with the ruins, living among these beautiful ruins, if you like, but not really, again, reconstituting the elements of it. Whereas, you see, as a Caribbean person, we start with the ruins and our responsibility is to rebuild those fragments into a whole society. Mackey asks him, which North American writers, if any, do you feel a consonance with? And Brathwaite says, you know, I can't. None of them has ever done anything significant for my guitar strings, as it were. And in this, I don't mean to imply no arrogance or undue ignorance, though I'm afraid there is a colonial, third world, non-metropolitan element of that in here, too. Well, in December 2000, I was one of the speakers at an event held in celebration of Kamau's 70th birthday, titled Between Caliban and Sycorax, Kamau Brathwaite and Caribbean Culture, held at NYU. The event featured a combination of panels focused on Kamau Brathwaite's work, as well as readings and performances by Margaret Gill, Dale Byam, Lasana Sekou, Pam Mordecai, Gabby, and Brathwaite. In this edition of Poet Radio, I will be playing some of the recording I made of Brathwaite's reading on that occasion. And we'll go ahead and listen to that for a bit now.
So this is a poem of thanks. This is a is a reading to say thank you for this moment. I see the evening starrow and the new moon together, sleeping in the velvet peace of tomorrow. Greetings, homage, libation to thee who dwelleth in thy boat upon the waters of the valley, awaiting the sunrise of space. The light coming out of this soul of the ocean, beginning a new village of day, a new page, a fresh inscription upon the scorpion of time, of white, of dark, of lips, of whisperers, and the bleed once love-wracked lonely voice of Billie Holiday, seeking chorus, learning the meaning of music, the meaning of music and horizon and need. Horus has cut off the lean head of darkness in heaven, where it lies in the form of fat and grease, in the plump body of the goose, in the winged harp of the blind serpent, become your navel string under my boabab tree poets. Harshly, harshly, harshly now, all the animals are here. All the animals are here in the tenements of fish. Every eyeville shall be destroyed before the evening drifting of nets into harbor, into the drifting of nets into harbor by Osiris, by the Osiris Ani, and by his mother, the model voice of the Isis of reeds and the nearby Ibis River. Rockamy, Rockamy. Rockamy love, Rockamy love, into the wisdom of your sleep, into the wisdom of your sleep, O violins of voyages, the drifting waves of sound out of the sands of this water, out of the desert, Rockamy, Rockamy, Rockamy love, into the wisdom of your sleep, into the wisdom of your sleep. O violins of voyages, the drifting waves of sound out of the sands of this water, out of the desert of unbelievable distance, before crouching sphinx and the many pointing shape of immovable pyramid. Placate the hawk before me in the visor of this adventure, the visor of this adventure. Let me swim forth, sing forth my love and my fortitude, and all my grievances of birthplace upon this dark mere, O sea, plunging so steeply, so softly, O sea, signing so sweetly, this tumultuous planet of paper, this star, this sitar, this silver. That is from Missa Solemnis, which is a new poem we are working on right now. The whole idea of this poem, which follows the Rwanda poem, both of them unpublished so far, is that for the first time I move towards the music of that other black man, Ludwig van Beethoven, Missa Solemnis, and that the magic, the wave movement of that poem allowed me to write a poem where I begin a voyage from the shores of Kaneshi and Takoradi and the west coast of Ghana across the Atlantic. It allows me to imagine what it felt like for a voyage across the Atlantic, not in a slave ship as such, but in a ship of metaphor, leaving one continent and arriving to the other. You know, qui venit in nomine, domini, steering this courial of his hearing towards the sun and sources of our Nam and native land. That's how it ends. May it go through the cradle of the Benedictus and the Sanctus and the Agnus Dei. And then there are a few other things. Some other poems here which I wrote, in a sense, on the eve of this occasion. On the eve of this occasion. You know, one sits in this strange garden of waiting, and, you know, something has to be done, so you make inscriptions upon that scorpion of time. And I said, O Lord, who bring me out of the house of my blind age, rise me up in the stirrup, into the wind, let me loose, to flout my loose limbs in the scarecrow. Bring me low in this hurricane, bring me low before the fasces of this judgment. These swift, SWAT, motorized troops, faces dressed in midnight and oil and the leather of whips. The harsh rind of all these hangings and happenings, so much of all these people's eye-water murders arousing in these pools. O Lord, who still let me sing. O Lord, who still let me sing. O Lord, who still let me sing to the harp and the sharp lightning. Light becoming flight across this ancient landscape of flashing holes. Grenades of thunder exploding out of the green palms, the pale palms of where your lifeline used to be ink. Resources, memory, napalm. Oh, these fields of Canaan sweetly burning. What was once burden lay down. What was once bondage broken. Stepping up to the lintel and threshold of where is my home. Hover of dust in this sorrow. In my blind eyes forever, however. Out of the sound of the chains of the metal, think of the space and the peace of tomorrow. How does one say thanks after midnight? The sand clock running down its funnel into salt. How does one, after all these years, hold back the leaves from falling? How does the mouse of time humble itself in the house of the eagle? And for how long does the eagle keep flying beyond the future of his speech? And when the singing is done, what strange echoes dwell in the closure? What new soft songs down the well of the rainbow? What dwellings of dream in the perching? So cruel is creation. It must be killing to be keeping. Must be the song beyond the passion, the cup beyond the potter's wheel. Not the wonderful face in the mirror, but the flower fall under the pool. We little guessed this Raphael was yesterday a baker's girl with flowers in her hair, or that Icarus was dying in air. So breath of the Lord blowing through me. Birth of the Lord Shango blowing upon me. I give thanks, I give thanks. Power of the Lord of the Oguns into my hands, power of the Savior unto my voice, power of the Great Spirit and Ancestor who has allowed me to open the windows of these eyes into the dawn. It did not seem certain yesterday. It did not seem certain. It did not seem so certain. Yesterday, and when my foot tripped into nightfall, it did not bleed possible. There was so much noise, lightning and flood and darkness. So much hunger in Bob Stewart's Valley of Drums. So many sunships wrecked coming up from Omowali's cooperage. So many flowers abandoned by the Ambus Bridge at Garden Town. So much blood among the leaves and scattered papers there. So many children undelivered, drowned in Count Ozzy's dream. And yet today, good Lord Anansi, am I here? Am I still here to hear you sing praises and for me to thank you? So many doors have opened with a shadow, so much at last of the language ajar, the bolts flying back out of the shadow of the prison of the metaphor as I walk pianissimo and pentameter free as I now wish to be. So much man talk of sex, riot and oblivion, of politics and war and insurrection. And yet today we free together on this hillside. Today am I complete in this poem made up of small true hearts and drum beats of Nkisi. And all the kisses that you give me returned into this river of bread, like under this waterfall, like out of this lake, like into this room where we sit closely together and listen to the roses, listen to grasshoppers glisten with the stars. Guillen's widow's eyes tell a long story, but a strong story of heroes dying at Moncada and the deep water wheels and wells of Camagüey. Anana Nancy Morihun, so far away from the home of the ultimate victory, but so soft, so quiet, and so beautiful. So many struggles raveled and endured. So many struggles unraveled in the liquid of the darkness of your eyes. There are flying kites on the other side of the valley, on the hillside just outside the village. I can hear them, the kites, singing and volleying their drumming up into the hills. I can see them coughle and rustling and rising and coming now into their one blossom of blazing sandpaper rising, bringing the most perfect gifts you can bring me, this carafe of sweet water, this loaf of wheat without salt, these carefree Sankofa eyes flying in heaven, this sugarcane juice, these few sweet cow pasture dunks, this blessing, and rhyming with heaven, this poem.
You're listening to Kamau Brathwaite reading his poems on this month's Poet Radio on WGXC. And I wanted to take a moment to offer a bit more backstory on my own connection with Brathwaite. In 1993, I was most fortunate to be in attendance at an event that was part of the Conversations series at Poets House in New York City, an evening with Kamau Brathwaite and Nathaniel Mackey. This is where I first met Kamau, and at which seeds were planted for a project he and I would work on for the next 5 years, editing his book, Conversations with Nathaniel Mackey. I won't go into much detail here, but after I transcribed the conversation from audio tape and sent it to him, Kamau reconstructed the dialogue several times, ultimately expanding it by applying the Sycorax video-style lens he became known for the past 25 years. In 1999, in conjunction with XCP, Cross Cultural Poetics, We Press, a small press I co-founded in 1986, published the manuscript as a book. For many reasons, this was an otherworldly, basically unmatchable experience. Along the way, creating the book, Kamau and I shared many visits, dialogues, letters. We were close for a while, and the project eventually led my family and I on a pilgrimage to Barbados to see some of his Caribbean world firsthand. This fabulous book is still very much available, and should you wish to obtain a copy, you can contact me via the radio station or social media, or look it up on eBay, or I always have inexpensive copies for sale. With that said, let's return to Kamau Brathwaite on WGXC.
Three things the artist said, or rather three things of the artist said. To begin to write, to continue to write, and to have written so that people will know it not only now, but in the future, which is one of the wishes of the art and the intention of the artist. Three things must be present, past, and future. Continuum of flute and space-time. And I claim it not only the indulgence and opportunity of the moment, but the privilege of what is perhaps only a momentary monument, but important nevertheless, and because of this, utterly unique. To say this and say this again, on behalf of all writers and artists, we IO laborers in the literary field, in the literary yard. One, that we need a place to live so we can write and be ourselves. That we need a place to live so we can write and be ourselves. Now I say this because 3 years ago I left here, and I found at last, after long journeying, a little place along the seashore of my own island where I felt, I thought, I knew that I could live and write and be at peace. And this is after, as I said, a long journey, because I had left Barbados as a youngster and I had gone to England where I didn't have a home. I went to Ghana. And finally I drifted down the Volta River, back to the seashore, back to the Caribbean. Went to Jamaica. After long years there, established a little home fort in the hills of Irish Town. And eventually the hurricane came and drifted that away. And I was left bereft and stranded. Came to this country. All this time, the writing continues, the leaves are falling and flowing, and there is no sense of concentration. There's no way to keep the bank of what is going on. No archive. And eventually, I came to my own island where I found this place, which I call Kaupastor. Not Kaupasture, but Kaupastor. And I thought I had at last found a place where I could write and be myself. And within 10 minutes of finding it, the government of Barbados said, "Not so fast, my friend. Not so fast. We want to improve this area. We want to establish eminent domain over your little chattel." And so a fight ensued, and the upshot is that the eminent domain proceeds, and Kamau Brathwaite once more, at the age of 70, has nowhere to live. The archives remain scattered between Jamaica, this country, and Barbados. And, you know, the sense of the falling leaves and the gathering of those leaves becomes more urgent than ever. I think that every artist, every person, frankly, but every artist, because I'm speaking as a writer, as an artist, has a right to a place where you can be yourself, a place out of which the illumination may come if it comes, and certainly where the struggles may proceed with some peace and respectability. when one is kicked around in the world that way, is an insult not only to myself, but an insult to all of us who love art, all of us who love literature. It is an insult to Beethoven, to Shakespeare, and to us. This should never happen. The sense of disrespect, the sense of not caring that this little spot means something, that that road that they would like to build is not necessary, that I demonstrate the unnecessariness of the road and that is ignored, is something that one has to protest against even at this late stage. Even at this late stage when the bulldozers begin to move, when those instruments with those sharp prongs begin to purr, when it is almost impossible, therefore, to continue the poem. Two, that we need publishers who will publish what we write when it is written good. That we need publishers who will publish what we write when it is written good, who will seek to promote our work as aspect, hopefully, of their own vision. People, publishers who will respect the artist even when they, the publisher, has to try to keep pace with the bottom line. You had a session on publishing earlier this afternoon. I'm afraid I could not attend it, but I assume that those issues were raised. I'm sure they were. But speaking as a writer myself, I have to protest again over the attitude of many publishers, because that bottom line becomes increasingly important, and the experiment, the effort, the hazard of the writing becomes subject to so much else. One is asking the publishers to have some, not only respect in a way, but to care about what is happening. To know that the literature, certainly of the Caribbean, needs to be nourished in a very special way if the fragmentation of that region is to be reversed. We don't have any central publishing house. We have efforts from time to time at literary journals, some of them outside of the Caribbean, some in the Caribbean for a while. But it is the relationship of the writer to the publisher that I am concerned with. And I call it that sense of respect or disrespect. You cannot receive a writer's manuscript and keep it for 5 years, or 10 years, or 17 years. Gordon Rollier spoke about what happened to him this morning, and I empathize, I sympathize, I understand. It is not easy, but what is the point of writing if the writing is not going to be carried forward, and if it is not going to be carried forward with care and love and understanding? The publisher and the writer have to have some common vision. That is the point I'm making. And I would also like, on the subject of publishing, let me borrow this book a moment. This morning, in the heat of battle, when I was speaking about the failure of so many publishers in my experience to recognize the video style, because I can tell you that I've had difficulty with that. The normal expectation is that they will not, they say they can't deal with this, see, because you're dealing with hieroglyphics now, you're dealing with an expansion of the margin, you're dealing with an expansion of the 4x6 or whatever it is. You're dealing with something that gets close to television. You're dealing with motion on the page, and the publishers are still very conservative. All present company accepted, because we know that you are here because you are not conservative. But I said this morning that I could not find a publisher who was willing to deal with this video style. Of course, this was a fatal error. This was something I hadn't. I mean, it is true, but it is not true, because sitting right here is Christopher Funkhauser, the man who took his own money and published Conversations with Nathaniel Mackie. Now, how could I forget that? See, here it is. There it is. shows you that it's possible. And it could only have been possible for someone who is outside the mainstream, who is prepared to invest in this kind of future, who has faith that it is possible for writing to be alternative other than what it begins from. So Christopher, I'd like to apologize publicly again for that omission, which is unforgivable, but to take the opportunity to praise you, to bless you, and to ask people to note the presence of conversations and to know where to find it in the immediate future, right here on that table. See, what publishers try to do is that they immediately wish to reduce the concept to this limited, this very narrow margin. And therefore everything is reduced, or better still, or worse still, it is rejected altogether. It has to be written in the conventional style, the Roman, whatever it is, 5.6.7.8. or whatever. But that explosion on the page, that music in a sense, which is possible with this development, is looked at with askance. And finally, that there be provision for the archives of our work, both personal and communal, both individual and national. I've said this over and over again, and I take the opportunity to say now, among such a large cloud of witnesses, people who understand what I mean by archives. What happened to my archives at Irish Times should never have happened, and should never happen again to anybody. That your material could be destroyed by a hurricane can happen to anyone, but that having that destruction having taken place, there's no effort to reconstruct, no effort to put it back together, to help it back together, to help shore up those fragments. It's to me another insult to the whole effort that we are concerned with. Not only that, but so many other people lost archives. And my point is that if you want to have a national culture, you have to have not only what they call the national archives, which are selected by certain government officials, but even more important, you have to have the individual personal archives, which should have as much attention and respect as any other. The two together, the personal and the national, form what is the future of the culture. Right. Now the first poem that meant something in retrospect that really, you know, I would put in my list of my own personal anthology is a poem I wrote when I was still at school. The first poem that showed me that I was exposed to the environment of Barbados, that I was aware that we had a country that had trees, that had flowers, that had songs, things like that. You know, I mean, after all, the model until then had been Gentle Jesus, Meek and Mild, the hymn book, and the various doleful hymns that come out of the various Episcopalian churches. That was what we were brought upon. And therefore, I could not relate to that landscape with any confidence, but I felt somehow that the landscape was there, that it was important, and if I was going to write, I had somehow to understand what it meant. It was a locked box, that landscape, just as everything else was locked, because the landscape was locked, the language was locked, my gait, my way of walking, my way of presenting myself was locked. My sense of ancestry, of history, was locked, and it was replaced by this medallion that was imposed upon us that said that, there is one history which you partake of. It is not yours, but you partake of it because it is better than you. And I began to walk about the island, and I began to do this on the verge of having to leave the island. But as soon as I knew I had to go to Cambridge on a scholarship, I began to roam the island on the 2 feet I have, to look at things as if I wanted to store them up, because I somehow I felt that this is a treasury which was going to be important in the future. One didn't know one would ever come back to your island, but you wanted to leave the island with some sense of it, if you see what I'm getting at. Because up to that moment, I did not know anything about the island I lived in. What my imagination was filled with was the imagination from the books I had to read, which came from foreign cultures. So I understood, I think, something about snow and apples and Robin Hood and the kings and queens of England and the River Thames and the Parliament buildings, you know, things like that. A lot of stuff I had on southern Australia. So I said, let me try to capture something of my own. I didn't think it would be of any value to anybody, because I felt that when I got to Cambridge, I would have to write like Milton or Shakespeare or the modernists, whatever. But still, my hunch was that I should carry some little packet with me, some little noun inside my purse, inside my pocket, some little piece of the soil. And I began to walk about Barbados. And this is one of the poems that I wrote in my simple mind and my simple style. Come with me now. And as I begin to, now before I was ashamed of the poem, I said, you know, but now I realize it is an important moment. It is the first step towards something else. It's the first step to being here before you this afternoon, in fact. Come with me now, and I will show you all the beauties of the island. The sand hills and the shadows, the sunlight and the stranded beach pools, and little children wonder-eyed around the bending fishermen, sand-cleaning conger eels. Come with me now, come softly but come quickly, and I will show you oystering tongue at vesper, with grey sea shadow creeping on the land and changing now the dark green trees to evergreen. Look for a moment from a lighthouse top and watch the waters leaning on the shore while further off a bird outflies a fishing boat. Discoveries. Discoveries. Watch the water leaning on the shore. I didn't think that, until that moment, I did not realize that the water in fact leans on the shore, that in a sense, the island is below sea level and that the sea is there about to topple over. I would not have thought that a bird could outfly a fishing boat, because the fishing boat was more important than a bird. But the birds do, and you know, it's amazing, but there they are. A little thing like that, captured in the poem. Pause at the bottom of the hill and listen to the shack-shack song so whistle-sad, and while the memory lasts, climb to the summit and inbreathe the cuscus grass, or sit and watch the oxen's patient genuflection. Cuscus grass. Until then, it was grass, or green, or it was sniff-sniff. But the words, what is that grass, I had to find out. Cuscus, there's so many. Later on, I was to meet a mild man at Mona who took my students outside of the classroom, that on the lawn at Mona, just right on the lawn, which is mowed every day. And he identified 15 kinds of grasses right outside our doorway. 15 grasses in that little space. So these are the magical things that the landscape contains. And he could name them. So that in future when I look at the grass, although I can't remember all the names, I know it is no longer just grass. But it could be piaba, or cuscus, or all the other various forms that there are. Come with an open mind and let the salt too spray your hair and pound upon the brown foundation of the cliff. But come at nightfall to the peaceful trees of Codrington. Stand with bowed head against the benediction of the wind and listen silently to how the crickets chanting in the dark. And in the morning, before acknowledging the salve of the birds, turn to the dawning east and read therein the sun's soliloquy. not bad soliloquy. I've been reading Hamlet. I had to get a change. But it was not my own. The son had become Hamlet, and therefore I felt the poem had some kind of, you know, some kind of validity behind it.
I want to remind listeners that you are in tune to Poet Radio on WGXC, where we are featuring excerpts from a reading by poetry reading by Kamau Brathwaite on this month's program. Brathwaite, who passed away on February 4th, was co-founder of the Caribbean Arts Movement and author of more than 40 books, for which he received numerous awards, among them the Neustadt International Prize for Literature, the Busa Award, the Casa de las Americas Prize, the Griffin Poetry Prize, the Frost Medal, Penn Vocaler Award, and most recently the Bocas Henry Swansea Award. As he was a unique and major figure in the world of global arts and letters, his passing is a great loss for us all. He was an enormous and crucial figure in Caribbean letters and culture for half a century, author of many incredible volumes of poetry and cultural history, and known for coining the phrase nation language, in which writers are encouraged to find their own voice of place. For Brathwaite, this meant rejecting European models and finding a way to use language it captured, as he put it, quote, that sibilance that the sea suggests, that glitter of the water, that syncopation of the wave, that feel of wind on the skin, unquote. He's already missed immensely. Without further ado, here are more poems by Kamau Brathwaite, recorded at NYU on December 9th, 2000.
I say the day the first snow fall, I floated to my birth of feathers falling by my window. Touched earth and melted, touched again and left a little touch of light, and everywhere we touched till earth was white. And that is the discovery in this poem, the use of the word touch, because that's what the snow is doing, and the poem was able to capture that in the way that one cannot explain, but these are the acquisitions of skill and certainly the acquisitions of metaphor. The day the first snow fell, I floated to my birth of feathers falling by my window, touched earth and melted, touched again and left a little touch of light, and everywhere we touch, till earth was white. Wood was now black or white, white world was bright at night, and water was black wood carved into two white swans. Birth was black water, where the white swans bend. Death was black water, where the white wood ends. The day the first snow fell, I floated to my death of feathers falling by my window. Left love unmelted, loved again to touch the little left of light. But all the world was dark, while earth was white. Now we run into time problems right away. Now tell me how much more time there is so I can... 10 minutes, okay. He has come. Is Gabby here yet? He is here. No? Gabby. Lovely, okay. All right, so he's fine. I might even get him to start playing while I speak. Right. Those were the poems that I learned in England in that sense. And then in Ghana, I have to tell you about this one, even if the time runs out, because when one leaves, you know, the country of your birth and the colonial nature of the language, you begin to learn a lot about yourself, about your language, about your literature, about the future of your literature when you go abroad. Because as a foreigner, as a stranger, as an alien, you begin to search for the language of yourself. You begin to search for your mother's milk of word. for the first time you begin to realize that you need to express your difference. And it was in Zurich, of all places, where I went with a friend of mine who was, like, you know, at the university. He said, come and go to our place in Zurich, I mean, after all. So I went to Zurich, and in that cold winter of whenever it was, December 1952 or whatever, 51, I began very vividly to recognize the Caribbean. Recognize Barbados and all the other things. And that poem, which you know as Calypso, which appears in Rites of Passage, was actually written at that early stage. And I'm going to read you the early version of the poem, which is pretty close to the original, the new one. But it could only have been written in a sense when I had removed myself from the island, but it also meant that I had carried that early poem, Come With Me Now, and all of the images and memories from that period with me. And I had also taken with me a discovery which had happened walking along the beach day after day and throwing stones into the water. Those pebbles we have along the beach, you pick them up, and, you know, children always, every time you come to water, I notice it in films, and, you know, every time you come to a body of water, you seem to want to throw a stone into it. I don't know why. But we had this business of taking the flat pebbles and skinning them along the water with great skill. That was a competition, right? You did it to win, right? And I, as I was watching this stone skill along the water, I began to say, you know, if God created the Caribbean, would he create it like Beethoven would have done, boom, boom, boom? Or would he have created it the way I was doing it with this skidding of the stone? Because the islands of the Caribbean appear to be skidded stones. So if God was a Caribbean God, as he should be, if he was a Caribbean, he might take a pebble and skid it along the water, and each skid of the stone would become a pebble. Each skid of the stone would become the island. But it was more than that, because again, I recognized for the first time that you needed to have some rhythm or music in which the creation would take place. And it could not be the ba-ba-dum-bum. It would not be that, because that is not us. And I discovered that it was that skidded stone which corresponded to the music of the native, the music of the Caribbean, the calypso. It was that pointillist movement of the out of which the calypso is born. That if I could therefore weld the concept of the creation of the Caribbean by God skidding a stone with the music of God skidding the stone, then I might begin to have a poem. And so in cold Zurich, I wrote the first lines, the stone had skidded, arced and bloomed into islands, which you know now as that poem in Rites of Passage. And as I was writing the poem, it was not simply the tup 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 tup, but I also heard the music of it. So it was the stone that skidded, arced and bloomed into islands, Cuba, San Domingo, Jamaica, Puerto Rico, Grenada, Guadalupe, St. Kitts, Nevis, Barbados, and Bonaire, speed of the curving stone, hissed into coral reefs, white splash flashed into clay, Bathsheba, Montego Bay, bloom of the arcing summers, flamboyant flamingo flower, tamarind tear tree, green of the arcing summers. Then I go on, in Dominique, the last of the Caribs died, last of the six civilians of a sunken civilization, died with his faith to the sunset, so his faith was gold to the last. Died near the beaches where the coconuts gossip and nod beyond the speeches of the evening tide. The islands rolled into green plantations ruled by silver sugar cane. Sweat and profit, cutlass profit, islands ruled by sugar cane. And of course it was a wonderful time, a profitable, hospitable, well worth your time, when captains carried receipts for rices, letters, spices, wigs, opera glasses, swaggering asses, debtors, vices, pigs. Oh, it was a wonderful time, an elegant, benevolent, redolent time. And young Mrs. P's quick, irrelevant crime at 4 o'clock in the morning. So you see, I began to weld, integrate the music, which was the effort to find a rhythm other than the traditional English rhythm. And by finding that alternative rhythm, I began to discover things about my history which I did not know I knew. That's the third important thing, to discover things about your history which you don't know you know because of your education. Because of the education, we were not told anything about this golden carriage from Dominica. I mean, you know, we heard that there were carriages and they were all dead. But to call him this gold civilian fell and all these things were things that I began to recognize as the poem began to sing itself. It began to teach me about my own history. For the others, there is no tradition. They have lost the memory by hours in the tom-tom sun, by the hot gutter of the lash that overflows their backs, by the scorched hope of parents mourning names of children stifled among chains when they had come to islands where the sick sea sucks the sand. Those things I didn't know before. In Barbados, I was taught that there had not been slavery. And I really was a Scotch-free person. We didn't have slavery. Eventually, they began to tell us that there was some kind of arrangement with Africans to come over. But I didn't say the word slavery. I mean, in the plays that we did, you know, the Agatha Christie's play, Ten Little Niggers, couldn't even be called that. It was called Ten Little Indians. That was getting closer to your thesis this morning. So that I began to learn this from the rhythms. So islands arc in the sun, mansions flooded with fun, the waltz, the billiard table and the boards. Islands arc in the sun, mansions flooded with fun, the minuet, the coronet, the dining table and the cards. Slave girls curved to the sun, young landlords lusting fun, the beach, the stable and the yards. That's how the brown skins came. You see her there, mixed in her eyes the rain and cane. One smile the sun, one sun the snow, they will be fools, mulatto. But what a black sand with the big splayed toes and the shoe black shiny skin. Now how did I get that? Because I had come from an island where the drum had been banned since the Garden of Eden. I didn't know, I mean, here, for some reason, the poem demanded in number 7, the section 7, that dealing with Black Sam, that he should have a boom-a-top rhythm. That is what I knew. That was the one rhythm I knew. And here it is, and what a Black Sam with the big spade toes and the shoe black shiny skin. You know, he carries bucketfuls of water because his ma's just had another daughter. And what a John with the European name who went to school and dream of fame. His boss one day called him a fool and the boss hadn't even been to school. And then I introduced the steel pan, steel drum, steel drum. This is not my way of dancing, hot rum, this is not my bacchanale. And so the poem goes on. So you see, these are the things that I began to learn, and this is why this poem is an important one within my case. Now, finally, because the time has come, I will just tell you what happened in Ghana. Many things happened in Ghana, because that was the beginning of my whole de-education, the reconstruction of my cosmos, and that is a whole lecture in itself. But there was an early poem, I don't think it has ever been published, where for the first time I sensed the difference between what I had been expecting as a person trained at the University of Cambridge and this new continent, Africa. Now you see, when I approach Africa, I approach it in the sense of a person who believes in Tarzan. You know, I mean, that is all I had. I didn't know anything. I went to Africa not knowing. I was being cautious, I was being cool, I was being controlled. When I wrote home to say I was going to Africa, you know, people were alarmed. And that stage, I mean, what is going on there? What's the matter with this boy? That he was independent. So I get there, and the first image that greets me in all my perturbation is what I call this beast. On the fullest half moon night before the rains, when walking homewards in the powdery half blue light, I see a lonely figure squatting in the avenue, as if admiring the view of lighted homes. It seemed a child there squatting in the avenue. I wondered why she was there in the dew. I shyly shunned my torch, and in the light, I saw the head, the smooth head, covered with smooth hair like silk. Then the soft head turned, stared, focusing intensity, two yellow glares like rising moons blazing in terror. And behind that terror, green, a muffled jungle world of silences and power. I switched the light off. There she squatted, still watching me. The smooth child's head now dangerous in the rising moon. And I had seen with Yeats, I had seen below that head, had glimpsed the heavy body, heavy feet, the horned and curious tail, and the blunt, thunderous claws slouching towards Takoradi to be born. See, once more you import the thing to prop you up. But, you know, in addition to that importation, there for me for the first time was this image of this icon, which later on can become the Sphinx in the later poems, which I will read another day. So let us leave it for Gabby. And let me thank you all.
Watch. Hey, comrades. This is Chris Funkhauser. Be sure to tune in to my program, Poet Radio, fourth Saturdays of each month at 7 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears.
Better day. Oh, yeah, yeah.